The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast February 18th, 2025. Every day, every day, every day, every day I read the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you. You said you'd stand by me in the middle of chapter 2. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked, where today the book under discussion is Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, a novel by Rex Cole. And my guest, whom I'm happy to welcome, is Rex Cole. You want to say hello or something so they'll know you're here?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good. Well, I'm very glad to have you. Dr. Rex Cole has an undergraduate degree from the University of Texas at Austin, has a medical degree from the UT Medical School in Dallas. He practiced ophthalmology here in San Marcos at Central Texas Eye Center for 48 years before retiring in 2019. He has looked in my eyes in the past and may have looked into yours as well. This is his first novel. Okay, I'm going to try a summary, and you can correct me if it's
okay.
Not. Yeah, all right. Bob Carson, the protagonist, begins telling his story on his 100th birthday. He's widowed. He lives at Sunset Acres Assisted Living. He says he wished they would have called it Sunrise Acres, but Sunset seems more appropriate, maybe. But he is both mobile and still mentally astute. He's interviewed by a young newspaper reporter and talks to her and ends his day wondering about, you know, what if those little changes, little moments when if things had gone differently, maybe your life would have gone differently. So the chapter after that begins a series of chapters of alternative life experiences. The first chapter is an early childhood incident, and it ends then with a different 100th birthday, a very different 100th birthday. These chapters alternate with chapters that describing sort of parallel experiences, but they recount Bob's life from the end to the beginning. And then at the very end, we have two brief, very funny final chapters. I think I'm going to let them read these and see what they describe. Two versions of his birth and a painful early experience unique to boy babies, as it were. Right?
And Jewish boy babies.
And yeah, well, I think at the time the imaginary Bob lives, it was routine, but it's not.
Yes.
It's no longer is, unless
yeah.
Unless for religious reasons. Anything you want to add to my summary?
No, that's a good summary, I think.
It was a tricky novel to summarize, I have to admit. Okay, so how does a retired ophthalmologist come to write a novel?
Well, my father always meant to write a novel, and he never got around to it. And so I guess in some ways it's kind of a little way to show my appreciation for my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought about it too, but didn't have a really good idea. And then I had an experience which is in this book, which I wound up writing about. It's the Mrs. Moore story.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed doing that, and then I decided I would write a book. And then my pastor gave a sermon one. Dr. Ben Nelson at St. Mark's Church gave us a sermon that I found was interesting to think about, and he had to do with knowing the end of a story, and so I developed the idea for this book from that, and then started writing it before I retired. Realized I was having a lot of fun doing it, but maybe I needed something to do when I did retire, so I put it off until I retired, and then I finished it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so yeah, I kind of thought the Mrs. Moore episode was, you know, crucial. You'd not done any writing before you had this particular inspiration?
No, I make a habit of writing journals when I take a trip, which is also in the book, and enjoy doing that too. So I did have that notion too that I was, it's something I could enjoy doing.
Yeah. The structure is very thought-provoking. I mean, I suspect everybody, and particularly if you get, as you get older, you do start thinking about what if, you know. What if that date I had with when I was a freshman in college, where it turned out after this first date that we both hated the movie, but neither one of us wanted to say that to the other person, and it kind of ruined the mood, and it would have been a great romance if it hadn't been that we both hated the movie. You know, that's what this made me think of. But I suspect anybody who reads it is going to start having that, you know, what if kind of experience.
There are a lot of moments that are just so tiny and don't seem to make much difference, and they have a huge impact on your life, and we maybe get round to it. But the biggest one in this book, I think, is the episode about a red light and whether you ran a red light or forced yourself through a changing light or not.
Yeah.
And
certainly it's the important because our protagonist Bob Carson meets the love of his life, and it's two different loves of his life depending on whether he went through that yellow light or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. We're going to, it was that sermon that made you kind of come up with the what if, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. We're going to talk about individual incidents and characters and the comparison, but I want to say something about the structure. And I have to admit that the first time I read it, I got a little confused, and then I think because of some of my own expectations, but then I figured it out. You and some of your readers call the characters Backward Bob and Forward Bob, and I had initially called the Bob of the first chapter Bob A. Now, that's Backward Bob. He tells his story from the end to the beginning.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And that's the way I think of it.
Yeah, okay. And the other Bob is Forward Bob. And I called him Bob B. Now, I've switched to calling it using the names. But I think the reason I wanted to do that is that Backward Bob lives the primary life, right? He's the guy who's thinking of the alternate life, right?
He's the guy who theoretically is living his life from his death to his birth. Therefore, mm-hmm. with every day that he lives his life, he has the wisdom of a person who has lived a long life. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know the incidents of his life. It's not that he has foreknowledge of all the events in his life. He just has the outlook on life that a person would have when they're 100 years old. And the other person does not. He's just Forward Bob, as I've thought of him.
Oh.
Forward Bob is just living his life like we all live our lives, from birth to death, and learning as he goes and making certain mistakes. And the question was, it wasn't written with the idea of providing answers.
Mm-hmm.
It was written with the idea of providing questions, and it's not always clear which would be, quotes, better, mm-hmm. And or even wiser, and or certainly more exciting. And so that was the notion.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, I realize that. Then I've still not was not and now I know, but I still not quite, because I assume that what if you enter each day with the knowledge and hopefully wisdom that a long life of experiences and perspective gives you, which is what Backward Bob asked in the beginning.
Yes.
And I assumed that the hypothetical life, the life lived by Forward Bob, was a life imagined, informed by that experience.
Living his life like we all do, and
okay.
Making dumb mistakes like we all do, and
yeah.
The other one you would think and hope would, his life is certainly different, but is it better or more exciting, or are we better off doing it the way we're doing it in real life. And you can come to some conclusions, I suppose, on reading these
chapters. Yeah, that does make sense, because there are moments, and it's not definitely that one life is a kind of a corrected version of the other by any means, either way, I don't think. You know, as you say, it's just different. You know, it's what would have happened. But there are times when Backward Bob makes, well, sometimes he makes better decisions. Not always, I don't know.
No.
Yeah.
One of the things that I had some trouble with, we were talking a little bit about this before we got on the air, and this Mrs. Moore story, which is a true story in most respects. Bob is an ophthalmologist, and he encounters this same woman, one as a person who's living his life backwards and one who's living his life forwards. And one of the things I've noticed as I've gotten older is almost a total aversion to lying about anything. And even little white lies, I resist that. And I think as a younger person, you're more apt to kind of grease the skids if you just mm-hmm. say some white lies here and there. But you just see so little good coming of lying, and it kind of builds up over time, and you just don't want to do it. And in this story, the ophthalmologist, it's the only story that has to do with being an ophthalmologist, he walks into the room of a woman he's just operated on,
yeah,
and he doesn't like her. He never has liked her. Yeah. She doesn't have any...
Can I read that? Can I read that passage?
Yes, ma'am.
If I can find in my notes, because that really is, you know, we might as well talk about that now, because that is sort of a kind of a pivotal moment in there. It's on. I didn't particularly like her. In fact, I hated seeing her. She seemed to have what psychiatrists call a flat affect. There was no expression in her voice, just monotone. There was no expression in her face, no smile, no frown, no excitement, no nothing. She was hard of hearing. She seldom had anything to say, certainly nothing that interested me. Her name was Mrs. Moore, and she was 84. She had thin, wispy gray hair plaited in pathetic little rows, which were always pinned to the top of her head with bobby pins. She had a head full of bobby pins. Why she never took them out, I had no idea. This is the day after cataract surgery checkup, mm-hmm. right? And he's done it, and he's leaving the rest of it to his assistant. As I opened the door and was about to make my getaway, I heard her say in her usual flat voice, "Dr. Carson?" "Yes, ma'am." "I want to ask you something." "Yes, ma'am." "Yesterday, when you were finishing my operation and you were putting the patch on my eye, did you say, 'I love you'?" Well, that was unexpected. Of course I hadn't said, "I love you." I didn't even like her. I needed to get home. I was tired. I opened my mouth and said, "No." I stepped out in the hall and closed the door. Yeah, and this is the older Bob.
That's the older one. That's originally I was going to do it the other way around, but I decided the lying thing would be dishonest to do it in the other way, and so that's the end. That's a chapter which you just read.
Yeah,
and that's the whole chapter, and the end of it, the last sentence in there, last words are, "And I closed the door," and we find out in the other instance where he lies and says, yes, he did say, "I love you,"
yeah,
just to grease the skids and get out of the room. That's when she responds to his response, and she contacts him about silly things that don't have anything to do with anything, but it still amuses him, and he comes. All of this happened to me, and that woman is real. Not her name, of course, but he winds up in eventually going to the hospital to see her, where she'd broken her leg. He winds up going to her home to give her a Christmas present, he winds up at her funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a special lady.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to be quite admired and loved by the staff at the at the office as well.
That's lovely. And the actual relationship that he has as a result of saying yes, it's also has some really very funny moments, which is, you talked about the visit to the hospital, which I won't ask if that actually happened to you. But it's,
that one did not. That
yeah,
part.
But
well, I visited her, but
very
the exact goings on at the hospital were fiction.
Yeah, a little, and we'll talk about that. So that's really so. In some ways, what hypothetical, you know, what forward Bob would have, the younger, more impulsive forward Bob would have done is in some ways the better thing, because it leads to this rewarding relationship.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And an old, experienced Bob who won't lie no matter what.
He missed out on
something.
He closed the door on that relationship.
That is really fascinating. I think you've answered the questions I kind of had about what was the presumed life and what was the alternate life. So in some ways, this is what he would have done. Forward Bob is what he would have done without the experience, without
yes.
the knowledge
yeah.
that he has. I can't help. In some ways, I want to characterize each life and like what kind of guy is it. I didn't warn you that I like to read from the books on the air because it gives listeners an idea of what it sounds
sure.
like. So, Backward Bob is married to Joanne and has no children. Forward Bob is married to Anita and has a daughter, Rebecca, and a son named Cole. So one difference is that Backward Bob's life is less full and crowded than Forward Bob's, right? You know, the 100th birthday. Well, there are people in the assisted living facility, and there's the reporter that comes to see him. But that's Backward Bob's birthday. Forward Bob's birthday there's all kinds of family, and the person who interviews him is his great great granddaughter, and so it's a much fuller life that he imagines as an alternate. Do you want to comment on that difference?
I just think I've had two happy marriages, and I think the decision to get married is for everyone to make themselves, but if you do decide to get married, I think who you marry is easily one of the biggest decisions you'll ever make, maybe the most mm-hmm. important. And the luck of the draw, the one of them wound up marrying one woman, and she was barren and couldn't have children and had epilepsy, and they couldn't adopt, and at that time, for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wound up without children and did the best they could
mm-hmm.
with that. And they're the ones who wound up with the very special relationship with dogs, which served for them as the best they could do
mm-hmm.
to find someone to love, and it was a dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other family wound up with two kids and a lot going on because of that, and
mm-hmm.
That the other family didn't have.
Yeah, they're different lives. I don't see that one life is an improvement on the other necessarily, you know. They both seem they seem full in different ways, I guess one way of putting it.
Right.
You know. Also, now that I finally have them straight, you know, or which is the life that has been that is being reflected on, and which is the other one, it makes sense that Backward Bob is kind of more purposeful and cerebral than Forward Bob. Forward Bob has some kind of spiritual, almost mystical experiences, you know, but that would go with his kind of living in the moment as you present
yes.
him, right?
Yes, that's,
you know,
right.
And so
he's not thinking as much as the other one is, but maybe that's not necessarily in certain ages a bad thing. And no. It leads to more impulsive choices and different results.
Yeah, well, it allows him to fall in love at first sight, and I'll leave that as a teaser while we take our first break. Okay.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
KZSM recognizes these local supporters of the 2025 San Marcos Music Awards. What's on Your Mind Design? Listen San Marcos. Kit Massage. Gumby's Pizza. The Price Center. Insomnia Cookies. Billy McNabb, Attorney at Law. Twin Liquors. 11 Media Productions. Jams Music. Miracle Leaf. Big Man's Kitchen. Christopher Paul Cardoza. 003 Productions. She Wolf V Media. And JJB Productions. Thanks for supporting True Community Radio. KZSM LP 104.1, San Marcos, and KZSM.org.
Choose to Be Curious is a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life.
I think curiosity is the basis of life.
I'm your host, Lynn Borton. I hope you'll join me Tuesday mornings at 10:30, right here on KZSM 104.1 FM, San Marcos. Come, choose to be curious.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking with Rex Cole about his first novel, Too Soon Old and Too Late Smart, a remarkable exploration in what it means to imagine an alternate life, what it means to look back on your life with the wisdom that you've accumulated over the years. Is that fair? Mm-hmm. Okay. It's fascinating to read, but difficult to characterize. Okay. As we already talked about, there are the two chapters in which Bob, the protagonist, meets his wife. And they both begin the same way. I was feeling good, real good. Could not have been better, in fact. I just left the wedding reception of my favorite cousin, David, and I had been a groomsman, which is why I was in a tux. He was in my Mustang convertible. The top was down, and one of my favorite songs was playing on my brand new portable cassette player. It was 70 degrees, the sky was clear, and there was a full moon. I love that. That's so evocative. And the question is whether, let's see, if he goes through, I can't remember which wife he comes up with, whether he goes through the light or not, but that's the difference. I think this is when he stops for the light. And he encounters love at first sight. He's been lured into a bar by some rather bawdy young women and then left
Yes, that's true.
In an effort to preserve his dignity, no doubt.
He's the one he was driving down the street in San Marcos. He comes to the square, and the light changes from a green, and the amber light comes on at just that moment where you're not quite sure what to do. Do you stop or do you go ahead? And this one, the first one, he decides he's the younger one. I mean, he's the one that's living his life forward. And he goes ahead and gooses it and goes on through the light, only to come to a red light at the next intersection. And then the car full of girls harass him at the intersection and call him a chicken for not going into the bar, which he eventually decides he doesn't want to be a chicken, and he goes back in the bar.
But being tired of being harassed by these women, he leaves, and he's walking out. A door opened behind me, and a girl walked out. I glanced at her, and we made eye contact for a moment, and all of a sudden, I couldn't breathe right. She skipped a step, then walked briskly down the street. I stood there like a statue. She was almost to the corner when I began to run after her to catch up. She must have heard me coming because she stopped and whirled around. Her long, dark hair whipped around her face and settled back into position. Her green eyes looked scared and gorgeous. My heart was pierced and pounding. I skidded to a halt in front of her and said, sorry, I don't know what to do. I had a choice, one I've never had before. I could just have stood there and watched you walk away, or I could take a chance. I had to take a chance. I know it doesn't make any sense, but there it is. Look, I just need to talk to you for a minute, okay? Oh, that's so romantic. Yeah. Do you believe in love at first sight? Is that how you came up with that?
Or do you know someone
who experienced it?
I don't believe in it. I know it. That happened to me twice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like that?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah. Very strange thing.
Yeah?
You see the person
and you know?
Yeah.
All right. The relationships are different, I think. And the relationship with Joanne, here he is meeting Anita, who is Forward Bob's wife.
Yes.
Then the mother of his children. You remember that he has children with her. The relationships are different. The relationship with Anita, as I saw, it was about relationships with other people as well, and about their kids, and about, you know, it seems like a very full life. But the relationship with Joanne had a lot of play involved, you know, whimsy and elements of farce and things like that. Is that the result of more mature backward Bob?
I don't think so. I think it's more a matter of the difference in the women.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything else, and so that's the way I would characterize that.
Yeah.
And
I do not know what that noise is. I hope it is safe to ignore it.
Okay.
Okay. Oh yeah. It's testing the emergency broadcasting system.
Okay, well, I'm glad it works.
Yeah, I am too, because that is what the function of this station is.
Okay.
Okay, and we need to do it with others. The volume on that was supposed to be turned down, but it is not. It's all right.
I'm okay.
Yeah. And you are listening to KZSM LP 104.1, San Marcos, Texas, and KZSM.org. I think I'll tell you that and I need to say that the opinions on this broadcast are those of the host and guest only, and not those of KZSM or its parent corporation, SMTX CRA. I don't know if we've, I think we're talking about some very thought-provoking stuff. I don't know how controversial it is, really. So I was asking you to expand a little more. So you say the two different women are, and their the different relationships are kind of inspired by your own experience, basically.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
So that's the so.
We're still all right.
Yeah, we're still all right. So that's the it's the kind of women. I was expecting maybe that you would say, since there's a lot of laughter in Backward Bob's relationship, that maybe when you know more, you laugh harder. But I don't know if that's true. Yeah, well, speaking of laughter and humor, it seems to be very important. Backward Bob explains the concepts of TUF to Mindy, who is the young woman who comes and interviews him. And this is kind of what he said. I'm healthy, and I think it's in large measure because I believe in short, tough units. What's a tough unit? A TUF unit. TUF stands for time until funny. And what it has to do is anything aggravating that's not funny at the time it happens. And what you have him imagining is a bird flying over your head and pooping on your head at your wedding, which is a little exaggerated, but, you know, all those sort of awkward things. Those moments when you say, you know, gritting your teeth, we're going to laugh about this sometime, you know. And then eventually you do. But what seems important, what Bob says is important, is how long it is before you are able to laugh about it. Some people are going to, like this I'm going to laugh about already, sooner than others. Some will have a short, tough unit and laugh about it fairly quickly. It may take a long time for some people to see the humor in it. They will have demonstrated a long, tough unit. Some may never laugh about it. It will ruin their first wedding, then their honeymoon, then their marriage, then their life. That's sad. It's good to have short, tough units. How did you come up with that? Do you have short, tough units?
I hope so. That came up in my brain, I'm afraid to say.
Oh,
and,
no.
It just, my dad had that. He believed in short, tough units. My dad was a very funny man, and he found a lot of things that happened to him where he was the butt of the joke, and he would tell the story. As did my first partner, Jim Pickett, and that's one of the things I admired about him. He could find the humor in a lot of things. And the vacation stories that are in here are that's all it's about. It's very simple, and there are two vacation stories in here, one for each Bob.
Right.
But both of them are just meant to be funny. They're not meant to. One goes to Italy, and one goes to
Alaska.
Yeah,
Bob and Joanne go to Italy.
Yeah,
and Bob and Anita and the kids take an Alaskan cruise. The choices of destination seem very appropriate for these two different lives that you've postulated. You
know? Yeah, but they both have fun, and there are a lot of things to laugh at. There's just a couple of things that are serious in those, but that's the whole point. And early in the first chapter, Bob talks about laughter, how important it is. And I believe that our staff meetings at our office, when we used to have them, the first thing we did was show a funny video, and preferably some employee who had something funny happen to them. They would show the video, and if you're in a room with people and everybody's laughing, you feel a communion with those people and an attachment to them that you don't have quite the same if you're not laughing. And so I think it's really important. It's not the most important thing in life, but it's up there. And so I don't take it lightly, and all these little episodes that happen on the trips are things that went wrong, and everything in there pretty much really happened.
It's typical travel difficulties, the terribly tedious person on the cruise who keeps talking to you, and I can't remember if there was lost luggage, and there was all kinds of things like that. I kind of wondered. I kept waiting for the beautiful lyrical passages for all the wonderful things you saw and experienced. And we hardly, one line says kind of, well, we had a good time. I think that's Bob on the cruise with the kids or something like that. And there's another moment when Bob and Joanne hear, and they're kind of standing outside a church, but they're hearing a Vivaldi piece, and Bob hears his favorite movement, and he says, "It was a magical, unexpected moment in my life." But there's, you know, if you actually had those in your travel, they don't get into the book very much.
No, it's that was mainly just, the whole idea was just, it's just funny.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the one part that I can think of that is not, was where the Bob on the Alaska cruise, the forward Bob, sees a woman with a what looks like a fly on her back.
Oh, yeah.
And he knows from his rotation through dermatology clinic that it's a melanoma. And he delays, he's not sure what to do, and he delays a little bit and gets distracted, and then he can't find her and to tell her what he knows that to mm-hmm. be. And in the last chapter, he's still thinks about that. That's yeah. one of the things that he still regrets.
You're going to tell me that happened to you, aren't you?
Happened to, I read about it. It did happen to a dermatologist, mm-hmm. and he figured that he needed to do that. And I asked my dermatologist that, and he said it happened to him twice.
Mm-hmm.
And he told them both
mm-hmm.
that it was a happy situation, and he had to interrupt and say, "Hey, guess what? Mm-hmm. That thing on your back is mm-hmm. a tumor that could kill you." And mm-hmm. So anyway, he did it, and I would hope that's what I would have done if that had been in his shoes.
Yeah, but this is something, but you have it happen to forward Bob, inexperienced younger Bob.
Yes, that's yeah. right.
Yeah.
It did.
Maybe because he's more vulnerable to being disconcerted. I don't know. Or he's just because he's got the fuller life with the kids and all that.
Yeah.
It's easy to be distracted. Okay. There are a couple of chapters, very poignant ones, called the 75th. And each one of those describes the passing of the different Bob's wives. Okay. Joanne, backward Bob's wife, suffers it sounded like either a stroke or an aneurysm or something like that on her 75th yeah. birthday and doesn't survive. Anita develops Alzheimer's and deteriorates horribly over a number of years. That was an excruciating and very compassionate chapter. I thought it was really painful to read, but certainly very real. And because we get not only what happens to her, but what happens to Bob as he goes through these things. Here we go. I had a passage, and he says, and this is sort of fairly early. You know, the neurologist said all the tests were normal for anything important. He said he didn't know what the problem was, but that she didn't have Alzheimer's. This is in the beginning. Well, that was a huge relief. He gave her some pills. The pills didn't help. Anita had always been a kind, sweet-natured person, but then she became too sweet. This might seem like a strange thing to say, but it was true. It made me uncomfortable. It just wasn't right. It wasn't her. Her fire was not gone, but it was sputtering. She tried so hard to be normal. She would lie in bed in the morning after the alarm went off and try to remember things, anything, names, places, events, just to prove to herself she was still normal, that she wasn't losing her mind. Whoa, that's very powerful.
Yeah. That was an autobiographical chapter.
And you don't need to talk about it any more than you want to.
Yeah. Okay.
But I assume it was the hardest chapter to write.
It was the hardest chapter to write, and I almost never... I reread some of my chapters when things occur to me, but I don't like to reread that one.
No.
Why
did you feel that you wanted to write it?
Well, it's a death, and that's one of the things that happens in life.
Mm-hmm. And a difficult death like that one.
Yeah, you know, I've lost loved ones in different ways, and at the end of that chapter, and at the end of the other chapter, Bob has the exact same reaction. The same words are used to describe the way he feels at the end of it, and because it doesn't matter how a loved one goes or what the circumstances are when they're gone, they're gone, and there's the finality of it that must be faced, and it's painful.
Yeah, and you do that very compassionately. Okay, one more quick break since I accidentally played several more promos than I needed to, but just this one.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Wittliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Wittliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Wittliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Wittliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Wittliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewittliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking with Rex Cole about Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, his first novel. And you've already mentioned that you make your protagonist like you, an ophthalmologist, although you only have the one chapter about Mrs. Moore about that. Although he does talk to, young Bob talks to Anita about why he wants to be an ophthalmologist and about the beauty of the eye, mm-hmm. which is a lovely passage. But you do write about medicine also in the chapters that deal with the death of each Bob's wife, and I thought I'm impressed that someone who spent so many years on being a physician and cultivating, which I guess all physicians do, that kind of detachment, is so attuned to what the patient and the patient's loved ones experience. This is backward Bob, and he's waiting to find out what happened to Joanne, who has had this episode, whatever it is. And now there I sat, alone in a truly ugly room. It looked sterile. Everything was too clean. It smelled sterile. Alcohol and disinfectant vying for attention. Why did these rooms always smell that way? I'd hated them even when I was still practicing. They'd put you in a place like this and wouldn't tell you how long you would be there. Then you'd wait for that plain white door to open and some stranger would walk in and tell you whether your loved one was dead or not. Or, as any reader might think, you know, whether you or your loved one has cancer or not. Or, you know, the experience of waiting in this necessarily impersonal room, and you go through kind of the details of what the place actually looks like, and there's one of those pain charts on the wall and all. And I just thought, you know, what enables you to experience it all from the other side so well? And did that affect your practice when you were practicing, or did you kind of have to put on your doctor face and be doctor, if you see what I mean.
Right now, I'm a patient, not a doctor.
Yeah.
I'm having plenty of medical encounters, and you know, I'm a healthcare. What's the term? I used to be a healthcare provider, and I'm not anymore. I'm a patient.
No, you're a healthcare receiver.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you're a patient, it just it's a whole different world, and. We went to my wife and I went to a doctor recently, just a few days ago, and the guy walked in the door and didn't say hi, didn't call her name, wasn't smiling, didn't really tell us who he was or what he was going to do, and that wasn't right. And we both picked up on it, and you don't have to be a doctor or not a doctor to know that that behavior was...
Yeah.
Not compassionate, and it's just a different perception that I have now that I've retired.
Yeah. You express it very effectively. There's a couple of chapters called "The Bully," and they're really effective descriptions of childhood bullying. And as I say, now that I have them. The Bob straight, it makes more sense that forward Bob is himself a bully, at least at first, you know. And I just thought your description of it was the kid that they bully has something called what is the
Golden Horror Syndrome,
which distorts part of his face.
Yes.
And he's missing an ear, and, you know, I looked it up. And so the poor kid is trying to walk home from school, and here's Bob and his friends. Charlie said, "Hold these," and he handed his books to me. He tiptoed quickly behind Jerry and suddenly grabbed the elastic strap on his goggles, pulled it back, and let it snap forward. To pop Jerry on the back of his head. "Ow!" Jerry rubbed the back of his head and spun around. "Hey, Frogman, eat any nice bugs lately?" That was the perfect nickname for Jerry, so I added, "Yeah, Froggy, how did they taste? Were they nice and juicy?" "Leave me alone." Jerry straightened his goggles and mopped the drool from the corner of his mouth. "I see you still have rabies, Frogman." "I don't have rabies, I can't help this." "Oh, a little Froggy has rabies," you know. And then as he continues, and then they wind up dumping his books. And he said, I looked back and he was crouched over them. He looked like he was getting ready to hop. We laughed as we, the cool guys, strode away. It felt good. Very well done. Drawing on experience or observation of kids? Or
Some experience, I'm sad to say. And I remember we used to make fun of a girl in our class who was presumably ugly, but she really wasn't. And looking back on that, my friend and I, we both, he said, "Do you remember this girl?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, we gave her a hard time because we called her ugly." And he said, "You know, she really wasn't ugly." And I said, "I know." I said, why do we do that?"
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed as a physician, when I used to deal with children with crossed eyes, they would do fine, and the parents some of them wouldn't want to correct it until they went to school. And when they went to school, they started getting teased about it, and then it became a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And until they had that feedback from their classmates, that negative feedback from their classmates, their playmates around the neighborhood just accepted them. And, so yeah, it's a real thing.
Yeah,
very hurtful.
Yeah, and you really do it very well. And now I see that it's forward Bob does learn. He learns to appreciate Jerry, partly because he himself develops Bell's palsy, which distorts his face.
Yeah,
which I thought that was nicely done. So he befriends, but he's already beginning to appreciate Jerry, and Jerry's, and you have Jerry reappearing or being mentioned briefly in other chapters as a longtime friend, right?
Yeah, he became friends.
Yeah, you've got the friend thing down pretty well with the four guys. Backward Bob's learning is typically more complex. He's bullied, and that's he gets a really fascinating insight. I thought I'm going to have to. He is bullied by a girl who is somewhat. I think she's older, isn't she? Dolly's,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, no, she's the same age.
But she's bigger,
because
they're at that age.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they've already had a. She's already been tormenting him. He's fought back, and he's told he has to apologize. I'm sorry I hit you. You're a girl. She drew her fist back and hit me in the face, right on the nose, hard. Far and away, the most memorable thing about that moment was the look on her face. I have never seen such an expression. It wasn't anger. It was a look of profound, helpless anguish. She began to cry and ran inside her house. I should have been mad or humiliated again, but I wasn't. I felt sad. Sad for me and sad for Dolly. The look on her face haunted me. It was an expression that was hard to hate. And that's quite a lesson for a kid to learn.
Yeah.
You know, how did you come up with that, or do you want to comment on that? I just thought it was quite beautiful.
I got the main idea for that story from the same priest who gave the sermon, but his story didn't end that way, and. I wanted to tell a story about forgiveness, and that's what it took for this guy to straighten that situation out. And he winds up dating Dolly later in the book.
Yeah, I know. I noticed that.
But at that time, he just it comes time for him to either hit her back or to do something different, and just basically winds up forgiving her, and then finds out that she had a very good reason for her behavior.
Yeah, and he sees, but he forgives her because he is able to see, and that's what I thought was certainly that wisdom that you've been talking about. He is able to see that her bullying comes from a place of her own pain.
Yes. You know,
and then he empathizes with that. I thought that was lovely. The Christmas chapters are very different. Backward, and we haven't talked about. Do you want to talk about dogs in this? You know, there's a lot of memorable dogs. The Backward Bob's and Joanna's Christmas is about the loss of a beloved dog, and Bob is so engaged with it that he writes imaginary dialogue for the dog's relationship with the squirrel.
Yes.
Which is...
The squirrel was Elvis.
Elvis.
Named
Elvis. If he's an assertive sort of squirrel, that's what you'd expect.
He begins, the dog is making, has moved in with the family and basically kind of taken over and proved himself helpful to his wife and is just there for every moment of that woman's life. Mm-hmm. And since he loves his wife, he's very much attached to the dog as well. But the dog is really his wife's dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog is killed in an accident from another dog who attacks him. And it prompts the wife to write some kind of a eulogy to the dog, which is supposed to be just hers, and he finds it and reads it.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting moment when she says, but that was mine, and she doesn't, at least initially, she doesn't appreciate him having read it.
Yeah.
You know, that was very touching and very, a realistic depiction of the kind of stuff that happens in marriages,
I think.
You know, I like that. So there's that Christmas, and then there's a very strange Forward Bob and Anita, and have They open a Christmas package that's addressed to them, but the contents are obviously intended for someone else, and this becomes this long, kind of almost mystery quest in which they try to find who this stuff was intended for, which they, well, it's fun to read. I won't give away the ending, but they try to find out, you know, well, who was Grand, it was for some little boy from Grandma, and they try to...
To Ken from Grandma. The presents are obviously of sentimental value to who was supposed to get them, and so that intensifies their effort to find the owner, and they go through a lot of... And there are hardly any clues to speak of, and they eventually...
Did you make that up? Partly?
Some of it I did. Some of it was an experience my younger boy had. He wound up reading that story on Moth, on the PBS program Moth.
Oh.
And it doesn't follow it exactly, but that was the nexus for the story.
All right. We have five more. What did you want the reader to take away with your two Christmas stories? Or did you have a thought on that?
Just a contrast between what Christmas would look like because of what happened at the light with the wife, which resulted in him meeting one wife compared to another, and one could have family and one could not, and the difference that single incident at the light wound up causing so much change in this person's life, such a little thing as that, and.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and I like the two parallel lives. Okay, we've got four more minutes. Is there anything we have that you would like listeners to know that we haven't talked about yet?
I can't think of anything really. The cover of the book has a picture of an old man standing, reaching down, holding the hand of a toddler, and they're looking at a sunset over the hill country, the Texas hill country, and the idea was that the old man is either looking at a sunrise or a sunset, depending on whether he's the forward Bob or the backward Bob, and the little kid is either looking at a sunrise or a sunset, depending on whether he's the backward Bob or the forward Bob.
Now I get it, because I've been looking at this and thinking that it doesn't quite fit the novel. But then I read a rather different novel than you wrote, but that's what happens when you write a novel. You know, you put it out in the world and it becomes it belongs to the reader in some ways as much as to you.
Whatever you want to get out of it.
Yeah.
And as I say, it wasn't written with the idea of providing answers. It was it was just to broad questions.
Yeah, but it certainly gives a lot of the depth of the questions, and it's very very evocative for the reader. So are you going to continue writing now that you have written, I called it your first novel?
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I've thought about it. One of the things I was worried about when I did retire was what was I going to do with my time, and I find that I'm busy as can be. I would have trouble finding the time to write a novel, but I did enjoy it, and I think what I'm going to do is work on trying to come up with another idea and then continue to do that.
Okay. Well, Rex Cole, thank you so much for coming and talking to me about Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, and as always, thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.